Next up is Sean Burns, founder of Carbon Credit Corp, a carbon trading company based in Vancouver, Canada. Can you start by explaining how the regulatory landscape in Canada differs from the U.S. when it comes to carbon trading and carbon emissions?
So I think things are pretty much the same. I think both Canada and the U.S. have been avoiding carbon trading and carbon legislation. Although we're a signatory to Kyoto, we haven't actually implemented anything. It's similar in that the federal government here is a bit slow and that the initiatives are being led by the provinces, much like in the U.S. where the states are taking the initiative. What's happening here is the province of Alberta, which is the sort of Texas of Canada, has come out with North America's first regulated market.
So can you explain your company?
I had done some thesis work on carbon farming, and I was looking at how the monetization of carbon credits could improve sustainability for rural livelihoods, and started looking at how farmers could benefit from a carbon-constrained economy. So basically, the company was set up initially to help farmers receive benefit from carbon credits, and from there it's expanded on into other areas. What I think is interesting is that you've got farmers being important agents in global climate change. The basic kind of business, a farm in Canada and the U.S., is now an important player in the sort of global climate change world.
So one of the ways that your company earns carbon credits is through agriculture. Can you give some examples of how improved agricultural practices can help reduce carbon emissions?
There's lots of carbon that can be stored in wood and leaves, plants, and soil. And so there's lots of things that can be done to improve the storage of carbon naturally. One of the main ones is that over the last 100 years, about 75% of all the carbon stored in soils in North America has been released through tillage practices, so the turning over of the soil every spring. And by adopting what's called a no-till or low-tillage procedure or practice, you can reabsorb most of that lost carbon from the atmosphere back into the soil. There's many things they can do on a farm to capture methane that's being emitted, you know, from manure and composting, and to absorb more carbon in soil and trees and windbreaks.
And is this an accepted method of earning carbon credits under Kyoto, or do you think it will be under future agreements?
I think so. The first phase of Kyoto, to a large extent, ignored agriculture, forestry, and other land use. Ofolu is the kind of nickname for it. I'm not sure why, but most of the countries that have huge forests and land bases in agriculture were not included. And sort of smaller European countries were the ones that were involved in the first round. Canada, Australia, the U.S. just weren't part of Kyoto right in this first round. But I think in this next round, agriculture and forestry will be their big focus. Forestry is especially a huge focus right now. Someone estimated that the loss of absorption of carbon in 1 year from the cutting of forests in Brazil was equal to 2 or 3 years of Kyoto benefits. So that kind of put the whole thing in perspective.
You have a partnership with British Columbia's First Nations, which for an American audience is sort of the equivalent of Native Americans. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we've worked with some of the First Nations tribes in British Columbia, helping them to understand how they can receive benefit, I guess, from carbon credits. I think the main issue for them is sustainability. Many of the villages are in very remote areas, and there's heavy unemployment, 50 to 80% unemployment. But what's happened now is there's an opportunity to become, if you like, stewards of the forest. There's a new type of carbon credit called a red credit, or reduced emissions from deforestation. And these type of carbon credits drive money back into local communities and peoples to create jobs for them in the forestry sector, maintaining forests as carbon lungs, if you like. And so this is an area that we're focusing on and helping local people with.
I noticed that you have an MBA. I was wondering if you can talk about the role of market-based solutions in solving the carbon problem.
Ah, good question. Personally, I believe in sort of business for development. I believe that properly oriented businesses can be greater agents of change in the world sometimes than government aid agencies or even NGOs. In the business world, it's all tied to companies focusing on corporate social responsibility, also on a triple bottom line. Those are companies that set social and environmental goals as well as financial goals. And and set targets to achieve them. That was my interest at the MBA, was how can you create businesses that are socially responsible that will help mitigate global climate change?
If it's on a voluntary level, how do you convince companies that it's important to care about these issues?
There's a difference between voluntary and pre-regulatory. I think a lot of larger companies can see regulation coming and want to change earlier.
So is there a lot of money to be made in the carbon market?
Well, last year the world carbon market was $64 billion in trade. This year it's estimated to be $98 billion in trade. So potentially there is a lot of money to be made. And those numbers largely exclude North America because the markets here are just getting going. The U.S. will be the single largest market in the world. It'll be about $200 billion in volume once it turns on.
And do you see that as inevitable?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. Both parties are supportive in general of carbon trading and greenhouse gas emission limits. So it's clearly inevitable.